Okay, it's over to you, Francis, but I'd say maybe wait another couple of minutes because we're still getting people joining us.
Okay, well, I'll do this part on the on Makara. So, welcome everybody to this 87th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Moria Federation Webinars. Then webinar series in progress as shown here. I should probably update this now. Probably Robert has his name down in the, here too, doesn't he?
I haven't put it there yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
And he's going through them so quickly, he'll be done next month. So at that point, what I need to do is move it to the prior webinar series. So,
I see. Okay.
yeah, I guess I need to update that page. Just more of that story.
Yeah, give him his due, you know. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can also access any of these webinars in the home on the homepage of moriafederation.com up here in the left-hand corner. Okay, well, hopefully we'll get some more people coming in. Okay, this month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott gives a lecture entitled "The Irish Fairies." Scientifically considered to a sold-out crowd in Belfast, Ireland. So evidently no one had ever given such a lecture before, and it was incredibly popular. So can we get a reader, please?
Sure, I'll start off. We had a still greater surprise in store for the prejudiced public. It was this: leprechaun, banshee, dance she. I'm not saying these right, I'm sure. Martha de Down, a lecture entitled "The Irish Fairies Scientifically Considered," will, by special request, be delivered by Colonel Olcott, President of the Theosophical Society, on Monday evening, the 21st of October, at 8 o'clock in the Ancient Concert Rooms, Great Brunswick Street. Lay your ear close to the hill. Do you not catch the tiny clamor? Busy click of an elfin hammer? Voice of the leprechaun singing shrill as he merrily plies his trade?
Thank you, BL. Okay, can we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
This was said to be the first time that this most popular of Irish beliefs, superstitions, the conceited ignorance call it, had been handled in this serious manner. The Daily News, London, gave an editorial column to it and said that unquestionably, I must be a man of moral courage to stand up and defend a belief that it had been so long the fashion to laugh at, or words to that effect. The fact is, I wanted to give the tens of thousands of good people who secretly cherished this charming tradition the comfort of knowing that, under the classification of nature spirits or elementals, the existence of their fairies is believed in by a vast majority of mankind. To prepare for the lecture, I spent as much time as I could at the National Library in Kildare Street, looking up every book that treated the subject.
Thank you, Vivian. And next.
Ron, can you read that for us, please? Nadell, can you read that for us, please?
I found most of the authors who pretended to speak in the name of science displaying as much ignorance as prejudice. And one, I think it was Grant Allen, remarked that the Irish fairies went out when the bored schoolmaster opened his doors. He did not see the easy way to account for this fact. He did not see that the easy way to account for this fact is that the cultivation of the lower rationalistic faculty tends to cut off the finer soul perceptions, which put man in close touch with the finer forces of nature, and to destroy whatever clairvoyant faculty he may have inherited. So that while the fairies do vanish, it is only from the sight of the so-called educated brain, the unspoiled peasantry enjoying now, as they ever did, the realization of the next subtler plane of consciousness.
And while you're at it, why don't you go ahead and read these descriptions?
Pixies in the woods, gardens, or near flowers. Gnomes in quiet wooded areas and near the base of trees. Sylphs in the air, often shaped like clouds. Brownies on a farm or homestead with land and animals. Dryads attached to a tree or area of nature. Elves deep in the forest or in remote caves.
Thank you. So probably the, well, at least one of the most well-known examples of a human being contacting fairies was Eileen Caddy, who with her husband founded Finhorn in Northern Scotland. I spent some time there back in 1980. And actually she was still around. I had lunch with her, she would, especially evidently while in her bathroom, she would often be visited and they would instruct her on how to grow fantastic vegetables. And Findhorn, which is in a very sandy area of North Scotland, actually won prizes for the size of their, and not just size, but also the taste of their vegetable products, and became known through that. I think it drew a lot of attention to that area. Of course, now that is, that contact with the fairy world is not so prominent. It's mostly an educational center, but yes, Ariane.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, we sometimes have prejudice against people who live outside of cities. And I just want to share a story. I used to live at the Shivananda Ashram in San Francisco before everything was gentrified and closed down. And we a number of times took a walk to Golden Gate Park, which is a very choreographed park. It's not a wild place at all, but I am an urban forest activist. This was before I really got into it. And we were by a lake. There are many lakes in that park. It's a very beautiful park. It looks like Beaux-Arts in Paris, and or an English park, something more like that, not a French park so much, so often. And I stood in a, it was like before 6 a.m. in the morning, but it was light already. And I stood and I heard singing from one of the trees. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. I can't explain it. And I felt very shy. No one else heard it or noticed. I felt extremely shy and humbled by that experience. I could not even take it in fully. I looked down. I rarely have told anyone this, but I just say that when people think of the world of divas as superstitious, when they make up everything we see, both in the visible and the invisible world, we're underestimating what life is about on this planet. how complex and spiritual it is, and that there are different life forms, some of which are more evolved than humanity. And so it's a sort of hubris to think that we live in a human-centered world. And at that same time, as a human species, we have the power to destroy this planet. And so we have to come to terms with that. These other beings, these other fragile, invisible forces are implicated with our actions and the karma of that. And so it behooves us to take that into account, to just not pursue our own spiritual development at this time.
Thank you, Ariane. That's a great story. Yeah, it's, you can tell more by the quality of the sound and the, a certain kind of potency, its source, and not just by its location. Thank you. Okay, so during our last session, we continued our study of stanza 6, verse 7, shown here, beginning with what HPB calls the holy caste of initiates who came with Sanat Kumara to our globe at the time of the individualization of humanity in Lemurian times. Quote, as time rolled on, the holy caste of initiates produced but rarely, and from age to age, such perfect creatures being apart inwardly, though the same as those who produced them outwardly. Next, we learned that the form aspect of animal man during the early subraces of the third root race, you know, we're looking at well over 20 million years ago, was not yet capable of being the vehicle for a true human being. Therefore, a new human design, probably to be created under the department of the Manu, was needed. Quote, a creature of a more exalted kind was wanting yet, and therefore was designed, conscious of thought, of more capacious breast, for empire formed and fit to rule the rest. So, conscious of thought, of more capacious breast, suggests that part of this design to upgrade the human vehicle had to do with the heart and head chakras, thereby allowing for a greater capacity to feel and think, thus enabling the quote, empire formed or civilization fit to rule the rest meaning the lower kingdoms of nature. We then took a look at various forms of the living tree of divine wisdom, a metaphor used in many cultures, ancient and current, to describe the connection between the divine and the mortal worlds, with a particular focus on Yggdrasil, the Norse tree of life. Next, we considered another Carlyle quote, the essence of our being, the mystery in us that calls itself I. What words have we for such things? It is a breath of heaven. The highest being reveals himself in man. This body, these faculties, this life of ours, is it not all as a vesture for the unnamed? About which HPB says, the breath of heaven, or rather the breath of life, called in the Bible nefesh, is in every animal, in every animate speck, as in every mineral atom. But none of these has, like man, the consciousness of the nature of that highest being, as none has that divine harmony in its form, which man possesses. Then, after taking a look at MPH's summary of verse 7, we began our study of HPB's commentary on the first verse of the last stanza in volume 1 of The Secret Doctrine, where HPB introduces the, quote, hierarchy of creative powers, which are divided into 7, or 4, and 3, which we learned are the four bodies and three faculties of Brahma. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. So we stopped in the middle of this, so we'll just keep going here. Next, the highest group is composed of the divine flames, so-called, also spoken of as the fiery lions and the lions of life, whose esotericism is securely hidden in the zodiacal sign of Leo. It is the nucleole of the superior divine world. See commentary in first pages of addendum. So HPB is here speaking of the first manifested hierarchy ruled by the sun veiling Uranus. This chart was given us by DK, and he revealed much, much more about these hierarchies than HPB gave. Nonetheless, her description of this first hierarchy is absolutely spot on, calling them the divine lives, the lions of life, and its connection with Leo. Here's the cited addendum to volume one of The Secret Doctrine, which is called Science and the Secret Doctrine Contrasted. It's difficult to figure out exactly which passage HPB is referring to, but here's one possible candidate. So can we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please? Magda? I see you're unmuted, but we don't hear you. Magda, we're not hearing you.
Magda, are you there? Well, I guess we have to go on.
Okay, Mary, can you read that for us, please?
Stop. Can you hear me?
Maybe. Yes.
Yes. Okay. For the occultist, it is both spirit and matter behind the mode of motion, now regarded as the property of matter, and nothing more. They perceive the radiant noumenon. It is the spirit of light, the first, born of the eternal pure element, whose energy or emanation is stored in the sun, the great life giver of the physical world, as the hidden concealed the spiritual sun is the light and life giver of the spiritual and psychic realms. These beings are the sons of light because they emanate from and are self-generated in that infinite ocean of light, whose one pole is pure spirit, lost in the absoluteness of not being, and the other, the matter in which it condenses, crystallized into a more and more gross type as it descends into manifestation. Therefore, matter, though it is in one sense, but the elusive drags of the light, whose limbs are the creative forces, yet has in it the full presence of the soul thereof, of that principle which none, not even the sons of light, evolved from its absolute darkness, will ever know. The idea is as beautifully as it is truthfully expressed by Milton, who hails the holy light which is the offspring of heaven firstborn, although eternal, co-eternal being, since God is light and never but in an approached light dwelt for an eternity, dwelt then in the bright influence of bright essence in create.
Sacred doctrine.
Thank you, Mady. Yeah, so she's talking here about this first hierarchy, you know, the firstborn of the eternal pure element. This is also the Chokhmah Sephiroth in the Kabbalic Tree of Life, and we see it in the illustration of hierarchies that I think I just showed, didn't I? Let's see here. Yeah, here. It's this hierarchy that's being described. Okay. Here's DK's description of the first hierarchy. Could we get a reader, please?
Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Do you want me to read the top part or not?
No, just the text.
Okay. The first great hierarchy is emanated from the heart of the central spiritual sun. It is the Son of God himself, the firstborn in a cosmic sense, even as Christ was the eldest in a vast family of brothers, and the first flower of human plant. The symbol of this hierarchy is a golden lotus with its 12 petals folded. This first sixth hierarchy has for its type of energy the first aspect of the sixth type of cosmic electricity and wields special power. Therefore, in conjunction with the lowest fire, or fire by friction as it makes itself felt on the sixth plane, these lives are called the burning sons of desire and were the sons of necessity. It is said of them in the old commentary, quote, they burned to know, they rushed into the spheres. They are the longing of the father for the mother. Hence do they suffer burn and long through the sixth sphere of sense, unquote.
Thank you, Janet. Okay, but don't confuse this with an astral plane orientation. This is a very head-centered group. The desire is the desire to manifest. For it's the desire of spirit to seek the form aspect. So in order to lift up the lesser lives. Okay, finally, we have, they are the formless fiery breaths, identical in one aspect with the upper Sephirothal triad, which is placed by the Kabbalists in the archetypal world. I see Ariane's hand. Go ahead, Ariane.
Yeah, I just can't resist, but could you go back to the last slide?
Sure.
Which was just read. Yeah, that one. I'm working with various activists. I'm not a scientist or an engineer, so it's not such a great fit, but because of the urgency and importance of the climate emergency, I'm doing that. And I noticed that when people, that there's this distinction between people who just study things and talk and educate, which has it's very important. It's really important. But it's just the beginning of something to be able to think clearly and identify something and to know the issue. And then there's this next stage where it's related to this slide, where people focus on solutions and try to make manifest something that is a change process itself, right? And I think this is what you're talking about here in this slide, that this desire is totally impersonal. It has nothing to do with what we normally understand as astral energy that's all about the self, the small self, pleasure, even like enhancing longevity or something like that. And it's a sort of a signature of somebody who's at a higher level of their evolutionary attainment, that they not only teach and talk clearly and have a mental element, but they're doing something for the world that is manifest. They make manifest their thinking. I hope that's clear what the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, it's, you know, you have study, meditation, and service are the three elements of the spiritual life. And you can sideline your own possibilities through focusing on just study, also focusing on just meditation. You know, there are people who kind of lose touch with the real world because they're just focusing on meditation. Service informed by study and meditation is much more powerful than just serving. That is to say, just helping out. True service is, as DK says, the spontaneous effect of soul contact. And that's a necessary ingredient. Thanks for that. Yes, BP, I'm not sure who you are.
Oh, it's Barbara, sorry.
Oh, hi. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
So just trying to put this in context. This is from the Cosmic Spiritual Sun. So can we say this is the cosmic logoi that has created this hierarchy? And how do the planetary hierarchies relate to this?
Well, there's always a double. Yeah, you're right. It's the central spiritual sun that would be the ultimate source for this. It's always stepped down. As you look at the hierarchies, they're stepped down from, let's see here. Let me pull up our next slide, because that's what where we actually are. You'll see that there's a constellation and then a hierarchical ruler, a planet, that steps down this great energy of the constellational lords. So Leo has a particularly exalted place because it channels through our sun itself. In esoteric astrology, we're told that the sun veils Uranus as the hierarchical ruler. So it would be in this combination of energies that Leo works to channel the energy of these divine flames. But the hierarchy itself has to do with our solar system. It's the first manifested hierarchy of our solar system. So it itself is not, you know, at the level of, for instance, the cosmic mental sun, or the cosmic mental plane, the central spiritual sun. It is indeed manifest. Hence the, you know, the burning desire to incarnate. But this is the source of the creative energy for our solar system. This is where it all emanates from. Charged with the purpose of manifestation, these divine lives move into the manifested world by means of the divine builders and the lesser builders. Does that answer your question?
So would Leo have some significance for these cosmic spiritual sun? Is there a correlate? I mean, certainly within our solar system, but and our neighboring constellations. But would it have significance for the central spiritual sun?
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I would say that the line of descent would be the central spiritual sun via Leo, via the sun, you know, to Uranus. The Leo is the sign of the soul. So you can see since this is a second ray soul oriented solar system, Leo would have this particular prominence. You can also look at the rays that stream through, which are the first, appropriately, right, being the first hierarchy, and the fifth, which is the plane of the soul, and it's a synthesizing ray at soul levels. And so it would bring, it would make those energies, those ray energies available to our solar system. And then you look at the rays of Uranus, which is also the first monadically, but the seventh on a soul level, which is a ray that brings that which is on high into incarnation. So you have that the line of descent available through the Uranian ruler here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, so I want to back up one slide and reread this. It's talking about the first hierarchy. They are the formless fiery breaths, identical in one aspect with the upper Sephirothel triad, which is placed by the Kabbalists in the archetypal world. So because she's referencing the upper Sephirothel triad, which is up here, you can see these three higher HB is probably referring to the highest three manifested creative hierarchies. In this comparison, the first hierarchy, the divine lives, would be associated with Kether, symbolizing the divine will and the initial impulse towards creation from the Ein Sof, the infinite source. Appropriately for Leo, the ruler of the first hierarchy, the keywords for Kether are Aye Asher Aye, meaning I am that I am. So interestingly, the keywords for Kether and for Leo are the same. Those are Leo's esoteric keywords. Both Kether and the first hierarchy, whose energy is described as Parashakti or supreme energy, are considered to be the initial point of divine emanation, the source from which all other aspects of existence flow. Continuing with the comparison, the second hierarchy would then be associated with Chokhmah, which represents the dynamic force of creation and the flow of divine energy that shapes our solar system. This is in keeping with the name, the name of the second hierarchy, called the Divine Builders, whose form of energy is Kriya Shakti, the quote-unquote materializing ideal. The third hierarchy would then be associated with Bina, which represents understanding. It is the feminine, respective aspect of divine wisdom, often referred to as the supernal mother. The wisdom of Chokhmah becomes comprehensible through its interaction with Bina. So Chokhmah over here, the wisdom becomes comprehensible through the understanding of Bina. Transforming abstract wisdom into concrete understanding. This is in keeping with the activities of the third hierarchy, which DK describes as the devas who are ready for service and whose energy is Jnana Shakti, the force of mind. Any thoughts or questions? It's interesting that she's relating the hierarchies to the Sephira. It helps understanding both sides. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Oops, Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
I can try.
The same hierarchy with the same numbers is found in the Japanese system in the beginnings as taught by both the Shinto and the Buddhist sects. In this system, anthropogenesis precedes cosmogenesis as the divine merges into the human and creates midway in its descent into matter, the visible universe. The legendary personages, remarks reverentially Omoe, quote, having to be understood as the stereotyped embodiment of the higher secret doctrine and its sublime truths, unquote. To state it at full length, however, would occupy too much of our space, but a few words on this old system cannot be out of place. The following is a short synopsis of this anthropo-cosmogenesis, and it shows how closely the most separated notions echoed one and the same archaic teaching. When all was as yet chaos, kantan, three spiritual beings appeared on the stage of future creation. One, Ame no Aninaka Nushi no Kami, quote, divine monarch of the central heaven, unquote. Two, Takami Onosubi no Kami, quote, exalted imperial divine offspring of heaven and the earth, unquote. And three, Kamo mi musibi no kami, quote, offspring of the gods, unquote, simply.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, first, the same hierarchy with the same numbers is found in the Japanese system in the beginnings. That's the name of the system, as taught by both the Shinto and the Buddhist sects. So in Shinto, a lower but related trinity is symbolized by the Tomoe, which consists of three comma-shaped figures arranged in a circular pattern. The Tomoe represents the Shinto trinity of heaven, earth, and humanity. Each Tomoe, which is each of these sickle-shaped forms, symbolizes one of these realms, while the circular arrangement represents their interconnectedness and harmony. This is not unlike the Buddhist Trikaya or Trikaya symbol that appears on the Dayangro prayer drum. The Trikaya represents one, a Dharmakaya, truth body, the ultimate formless reality and essence of the Buddha. Two, Sambhogakaya, bliss body, the celestial form that enjoys the fruits of enlightenment and teaches advanced practitioners. And three, Dharmakaya, emanation body, the physical manifestation of the Buddha in the world, such as Siddhartha Gautama. Next, in this system, anthropogenesis precedes cosmogenesis, and the divine merges into the human and creates midway in its descent into matter, the visible universe. I puzzled over this one. It implies a non-theosophical idea that the divine essence first manifests in human form before extending to the broader cosmos, which of course is not accurate. In fact, the Shinto doctrine states that initially there was chaos from which emerged the first deities, the most significant among them being Izanagi and Izanami, the divine couple tasked with creating the world. So possibly it's this anthropomorphizing of the cosmic principles that led HPB to make the statement that anthropogenesis precedes cosmogenesis, because they array these great cosmic energies in human forms. Could we get a reader, please, for this?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Let's see, just a second. Oh, it's up there, okay. At the heart of Shinto belief is the concept of kami. Kami are divine beings or spirits that inhabit everything from natural elements like mountains, rivers, and trees to human ancestors and deified historical figures. In Shinto, kami are not strictly gods in the way that deities are understood in other religions. Rather, they are manifestations of the sacred that can be revered and worshiped. Before the emergence of the universe, there existed a state of primordial chaos, often referred to in Shinto cosmology as Ainari. This formless void was filled with potential, and from this chaos, the first deities would eventually arise. The concept of chaos in Shinto is not merely negative. Rather, it represents the fertile ground from which creation can spring forth, embodying the duality of existence and the cyclical nature of life. The story of creation in Shinto is dominated by the divine couple, Izanagi and Izanami. According to myth, these two deities were tasked with bringing order to the chaos and creating the world. Izanagi, whose name means he who invites, and Izanami means she who invites, descended to the primordial waters to begin their work. The significance of Izanagi and Izanami in Japanese mythology cannot be overstated. They're often seen as the archetypal parents of the gods and the first beings to manifest the divine will in the physical realm. Their actions would set the foundation for the creation of the Japanese archipelago and the birth of the subsequent deities.
Oops, sorry, I was muted. Yeah, I hope you're getting the connection here. If we go back way back, yeah. These two would represent Sephiroth, while still in the chaos, the impulse to and the holder of all the potential of creation, and then the means by which that creation, called the divine builders, would be, Izanagi for the first one, Izanami for the second one, would be the equivalent. Okay. Yes, Barbara.
So it is, I understand the tree of life, the absolute, the Ein Sof is at the top of the hierarchy. So it doesn't seem from Madame Blavatsky's teaching that the absolute is the head of the creative hierarchy.
No, it is not. It's it's altogether beyond the head of the hierarchy. You know, the absolute reflected itself into manifestation. This is the subject of the first three verses of the stanza of Zan as they appear in the Secret Doctrine. And that arising from that, beautiful metaphorical language, was the first Logos, who was an infinitesimal, at least Michael Robbins loved to call it this, an infinitesimal in comparison to the absolute. And that first Logos, absolutely devoid of all attributes except motion, would be the at that level of Ein Sof, not the absolute. Now there is a concept, and we're going to be getting into this a little bit, just Ein, A-I-N, and which precedes the Ein Sof. Ein Sof adds intention to pure spirit. And then you have Ein Sof Aur, A-U-R, which is the light that emanates from that intention. All of this precedes Kether, which would be, I think, something like the theosophical first Logos, you know. So, you know, whether you, it just depends on how you want to, I just contradicted myself because I said it would be like first Logos would be akin to Ein Sof. At a next stage down, it would be akin to Kether. It depends where in the evolution of cosmogony, you know, you'd be looking at in order to determine that. Kether is described as just the holder of pure life, just pure spirit, right? And well, that applies at all those higher levels, so it's not really that specific. Does that answer your question, Barbara?
Yes, thank you. Ein Sof is said to have withdrawn to make opportunity for life. So I think that, as I understand it, HPB is the absolute is just radiating.
It's nothing can be said about it. It's truly incognizable. It doesn't radiate because radiation suggests a source and that which radiates from the source. And the absolute stands beyond that whole dualistic concept altogether, you know. It becomes, Michael Robbins used to love to talk about this, but in truth, it's so absolutely beyond our comprehension that it's mostly a question of trying to find in the English language a way of pitching it upwards, you know. So in the stanzas, for instance, the verses, the first verses, there are no positive statements at all about the absolute, meaning that it can only be described in terms of negatives. It is not this. This had not yet happened. Right, that type of statement. There's almost no declarative positive statements about the absolute because none can be made. You know, it's very much like the one about whom not may be said, which by the way is at a much, much lower level than the absolute, because that's a, you know, that's a local congeree of constellations within, you know, our galaxy. But already it has the moniker of, you know, the one about whom not may be said. So if that has it, you know, certainly the absolute cannot be described.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ariane.
Yeah, I have a few different points. One is when you think about the fact that a lot of Buddhists in the East, they don't, or like Zen Buddhists in America, they don't believe in God. They deny the existence of God. But I believe that Buddha just said one cannot talk about God. We don't have the language or the capacity to fathom God. And so there's that confusion. And there's no distinction that there could be a hierarchy or of gods. That is to say, everything is evolving, the planets, the suns, you know, there's no sense of that. There's like this small, you know, from Hubis mindedness, like our God, the God of, you know, Sanakumara or whomever you think God is, that is the God. And so that it's hard to know who's talking about what a lot of the time. But I wanted to mention what this conversation that you're bringing up today brings to mind for me is that when you look at the Tibetan Buddhist paintings, the mandalas of like the demons and such, one has a sense that the focus is less about the creation of cosmos, but the creation of one's personal reality through projection. Like, what is the contents of one's inner world, like the demons and the astral challenges that one faces in a spiritual life of the individual through meditation, for example. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because, you know, Zen and Chan, that the original Zen came from Chan, which talked about all nature being populated by demons and spirits. And Zen and Japan, which comes from it, you know, upholds the fact that there is like a pantheistic universe, that there is some kind of force, some spiritual force emanating through nature and such things. And the distinction that I want to make that brings it back to the individual is that when we look at our inner world, when we're on a spiritual path, we have to come to terms with the chaos within our world when we start observing ourself, our thoughts, our feelings, our actions. And in the Bible and in these stories that you're relating, I have not studied the Tree of Life in esoteric Judaism or anything like that, or even Japanese mythology, that seems to be like the initial experience when one starts the initiatory process. It's not just that God created the cosmos out, there was the void, there were the waters, there was the logos, all these ideas. It's that within ourselves as individuals, we're going to have to grapple with these same processes that are overwhelming and disorienting. And then we understand how our thoughts and feelings are projected onto the outer world and create reality.
Yeah, we can't help but use the symbolism that is part of our own, that peoples our own consciousness, and project it at many, many, many octaves upward and downward in order to create a language that describes, you know, these realities. But then you have great seers, avatars, who come in and describe these situation, these stages and states of consciousness, and it's that you really want to pay attention to, because they have a more direct awareness of these. Okay, we need to move on. Next, the legendary personages remarks reverentially Amoye, having to be understood as the stereotyped embodiment of the higher secret doctrine and its sublime truths. To state it at full length, however, would occupy too much of our space, but a few words on this old system cannot be out of place. So Amoye is almost certainly Amoikani. I can find no other reference to Amoye, who is a revered deity in Shinto, who here seems to be introducing the Shinto secret doctrine. Amoikani is the kami, or god of wisdom and intelligence, whose name means having the wisdom and thoughtfulness of many people, interestingly. According to Shinto mythology, he is often called upon to provide counsel and guidance during important deliberations among the other kamis, or heavenly deities, which very much suggests the role of Mercury. Next, the following is a short synopsis of this anthropocosmogenesis, and it shows how closely the most separated notions echoed one and the same archaic teaching. And that's really the theme here, is how you have the three in one, the one and the seven, and the qualities of those 1, 3, 4, and 7. Separated notions echoing one and the same archaic teachings suggests the universality of certain elements of the ageless wisdom. Next, when all was as yet chaos, Kon Ton, three spiritual beings appeared on the stage of future creation. Ame no Ani Nakanushi no Kami, divine monarch of the central heaven. Ame no Minakanushi no Kami is one of the earliest deities to appear in the Shinto creation myths. He is a primordial god and chief among the Koto Amatsu Kami, the distinguished heavenly gods who existed before the creation of the world. That's the important point. They're not created gods, but all reside in potential. His name translates to Lord of the August Center of Heaven. Notice August and the Leo connection. In the first hierarchy, signifying his central and supreme position in the heavenly realm. Next, Takami Onosubi no Kami, exalted imperial divine offspring of heaven and the earth. So Takamimusubi no Kami is a primordial self-generated creator god, responsible for initiating conditions that could support human life and society, with an emphasis on agriculture. In this illustration, the second god of the Japanese triad stands on a giant mythical catfish called Namazu, who exoterically represents earthquakes, but esoterically represents both the negative and positive forces of change, including social justice and redistribution of wealth. Takamimusubi uses a sacred stone called a Kanabi Ishi to subdue the disruptive energy of Namazu, suggesting that, like Vishnu, Takamimusubi is a sustainer god. By the way, Takamimusubi is the father of Omoi Kani, the god of wisdom who's telling this story. Finally, third, Kamumi Musubi no Kami, offspring of the gods, simply. The name Kami Musubi literally means deity affecting the force of creation. She represents the mother, or Bina, aspect among the three primordial Japanese gods and is responsible for fertility and nurture, much like the Egyptian Isis. So here are the three primordial Shinto gods just described. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. These were without form or substance, our Rupa triad, as neither the celestial nor the terrestrial substance had yet differentiated, nor had the essence of things been formed. In the Zohar, which is now arranged and re-edited by Moses de Leon, with the help of Syrian and Chaldean Christian Gnostics in the 13th century, and corrected and revised still later by many Christian hands, is only a little less esoteric than the Bible itself. This divine vehicle no longer appears as it does in the Chaldean Book of Numbers. True enough, Ein Sof, the absolute endless nothing, uses also the form of the One, the manifested heavenly man, the first cause, as its chariot, Merkaba in Hebrew, Vahan in Sanskrit, or vehicle to descend into and manifest through in the phenomenal world. But the Kabbalists neither make it plain how the Absolute can use anything or exercise any attribute whatever, since as the Absolute, it is devoid of attributes. Nor do they explain that in reality it is the first cause, Plato's Logos, the original and eternal idea that manifests through Adam Kadmon, the second Logos, so to speak.
Thank you. Okay, first, still referring to the Shinto gods, collectively known as the Koto Amatsu Kami, quote, "These were without form or substance, our Arupa triad, as neither the celestial nor the terrestrial substance had yet differentiated, nor had the essence of things been formed." So important here is that neither the celestial nor the terrestrial substance, so not even the highest subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, had differentiated yet. This passage places the Japanese triad at the level of the three logoi before the descent into matter, quote, "nor had the essence of things been formed," suggests that even differentiated monads had not yet come into being. Next, in the Zohar, which is now arranged and re-edited by Moses Leon with the help of Syrian and Chaldean Christian Gnostics in the 12th century, and corrected and revised still later by many Christian hands, is only a little less exoteric than the Bible itself. This divine vehicle no longer appears as it does in the Chaldean Book of Numbers. So here's a 16th century copy of Moses de Leon's Zohar, which HPB here suggests is a exoteric rewriting of the Chaldean Book of Numbers. That is, because the authors didn't have that divine understanding, it's filled with error. Though unavailable to the public, many believe that the Chaldean Book of Numbers survives and is held in the Vatican Library. Can we get a reader, please?
Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. "It is certain that Ibn Jabirul based his doctrine upon the oldest Kabbalistic sources, namely the Chaldean Book of Numbers, as well as some no longer extant, Midrashim the same, no doubt, as those used by Moses de Leon. The entire scheme is in the Chaldean Book of Numbers, and even in the Zohar, if one only understood the meaning of the apocalyptic, hints, first comes M. Sof, the concealed of the concealed, then the point, Sephira, and the later Sephiroth, then in the Azeotic world, a world of emanations that gives birth to three other worlds called the throne, the abode of pure spirits, the second, the world of formation, or Yetzirah, the habitat of the angels who sent forth the third or world of action, the Asiatic world, which is the earth or our world, and yet it is said of it that this world, also called Kripath, containing the six other spheres and matter, is the residence of the Prince of Darkness.
Thank you. Okay, we're not gonna do a deep dive into this. The idea is to reveal the primacy of the Chaldean Book of Numbers over any of the other sources that deal with the Sephiroth. Okay, next, true enough, Ein Sof, the absolute endless no thing, uses also the form of the One, the manifested heavenly man, the first cause, as its chariot, Merkaba in Hebrew, Vahan in Sanskrit, or vehicle, to descend into and manifest through in the phenomenal world. So described here as the absolute is Ein Sof, which reflects itself into the first logos, and then initiates universal manifestation, as described in the first three stanzas of Zohar. In Kabbalistic mysticism, Ayin, seen here at the center of the upper circle, represents the absolute, unknowable, and infinite source of all existence. Ayin Sof, the second circle, is described as the stage where the divine begins to limit itself or contract in order to allow for creation. It represents the infinite potential and boundlessness of the divine. If Ayin is the circle, Ayin Sof is the circle with the point at the center, at the highest possible level of that metaphor, symbol. However, HPB often conflates these two stages, as she does in this passage, calling Ayin Sof the absolute endless no thing, when really that would belong to the stage here called Ayin, that central quality. Ayin Sof would then become the intention of potential. You see, it's just stacking English words on top of each other in such a way that you might shed some light. But who knows about these stages and its states of consciousness? You know, these are, a master of wisdom. Well, let's going even higher. A sixth initiate is grappling with understanding the monadic plane. This level is so far beyond that, into cosmic levels, that, you know, at one point, I'm sure this was given by some great cosmic avatar to, you know, to somebody who recorded these ideas. But for us to try to negotiate any true understanding, I would just say it's not profitable to because it's not possible to really gain any true understanding of the significance of the differences. But be that as it may, Ein Sof, Aur, here represents, means limitless light. The first emanation from Ein Sof, the primordial light that precedes creation. So these three Kabbalistic stages are somewhat related to the three Logoi, though they're on a higher level. The vehicle or Vahan by which manifestation takes place is often depicted as a bird, such as Garuda, who carries Vishnu from the causal realms into the phenomenal world. A great story about Garuda, shown here as a great eagle, that I like is that on his own plane of existence, he's a bird of unimaginable beauty, but the moving into the lower subplanes of the cosmic physical plane distorts that beauty in the eyes of the beholder. And what, in other words, we can't see it. And therefore, a certain grotesqueness takes its place, which I find a philosophically fascinating concept that we just simply are unable to have an experience of the kind of beauty that is on this higher plane, and therefore that beauty is distorted into what we imagine to be ugliness. Then finally, but the Kabbalists neither make it plain how the Absolute can use anything or exercise any attribute whatever, since as the Absolute, it is devoid of attributes, nor do they explain that in reality, it is the first cause, Plato's Logos, the original and eternal idea that manifests through Adam Kadmon, the second Logos, so to speak. Okay, so we find HBB's definition of the Absolute on page 2 of the proem of the Secret Doctrine, quote, "It is the dark mystery of non-being, unconscious, yet absolute consciousness, unrealizable, yet the one self-existing reality, truly a chaos to the sense, a cosmos to the reason. Its one absolute attribute, which is itself eternal, ceaseless motion, is called in esoteric parlance, the great breath, which is the perpetual motion of the universe in the sense of limitless, ever-present space. That which is motionless cannot be divine, but then there is nothing, in fact, and reality absolutely motionless within the universal soul." Verse 5 of stanza 1 tells us more about the Absolute. It doesn't tell us anything more about the Absolute. Those are just the only words I have, right? Darkness alone filled the boundless all, for father, mother, and son were once more one, and the son had not awakened yet for the new wheel and his pilgrimage thereon. Okay, this is just, you know, an attempt to pitch it into a level that will basically, the main function is to stimulate the intuition. Okay, back to the text. Now that we are up to speed on the theosophical definition of the Absolute, we can better understand, perhaps, the point HPB is here making, which is that the Kabbalists mistakenly assign the Absolute as the source of manifestation, which is philosophically untenable, since the Absolute is devoid of attributes, including the capacity to initiate creation. In reality, HPB here tells us, it is the quote-unquote first cause, Plato's Logos, the original and eternal idea, rather than the Absolute, that manifests through Adam Kadmon, the second Logos. On page 4 of the Secret Doctrine, HPB defines this first cause as the first differentiation in the periodical manifestation of the ever-eternal nature, sexless and infinite, Aditi in that, from the Rig Veda, the point in the disk, or potential space within abstract space. Aditi, or potential space, which is considered to be feminine, is described in the Theosophical Glossary as both the primordial light and the waters of space. Thus, Aditi in that represents the all potential of the point, symbolizing the pure eternal idea of the Logos at the center of the circle, which in this context represents abstract space. The point becomes a diameter, symbolizing the second Logos, which HPB here calls Adam Kadmon, but as we'll discover, this is inconsistent with other Secret Doctrine passages which describe Adam Kadmon as the manifested universe, which is a function of the third, not the second, logos. Thoughts or questions? Yeah, I know this is very heavy material, very difficult to get a solid grasp on. Yeah, especially a solid grasp on. Mainly because even contemplating Chokma and Bina, in other words, the creator in potential, and then those beings, the creator gods who actually bring that potential into being, you know, that's about as high as we can stretch. We can maybe philosophically say, yeah, there's something beyond that that's just pure spirit. But all these stages, you know, Kether, Ayin Sof Aur, Ayin Sof, and then Ayin, and then the absolute, it's like you're standing inside a building in the first story trying to visualize what the 100th story looks like. And yet, in fact, it has nothing to do with stories in a building. It's something altogether beyond being above anything that we can conceive. Yes, Nadell.
Almost like, so I think it's in the beginning of esoteric astrology where it says that space is an entity. Space, if space is itself the entire vault of heaven, well, what's beyond that? I mean, you know, it's like,
yeah,
pointless.
Yeah, literally. It's that which reflected the universe into existence. Space is the body of, you could say, of the first logos. But that space is not outer space, not what we see, not what we measure when we're looking, you know, beyond the atmosphere. It's space, as is described in Theosophy, is the source of that outer space. It's the potential for extension into the lower dimensions. So, thanks, Nadell. Okay, let's see here. Where am I? Yeah, so here's Adam. Come on. Yeah, yeah.
Francis, I just wanted to say what you and Nadell were just talking about. It reminds me of that phrase, the one in whom we live and move and have our being.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's... what is that? I mean, you could say that's the soul. But then you say, no, ultimately it's the monad. But then where's the monad lives in the sun. So ultimately it's the heart of the sun and the central spiritual sun, you know. And then you just have begun to climb the ladder, you know, of that which in which we move and have our being. It's often used as a descriptor for the planetary logos. You know, I think that's mostly what it's used for, in fact. But you can see how, if you literally look at the words, it can apply at so many levels. Okay, so yeah, Adam Kadmon. Okay. Next up, reader, please.
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
In the Book of Numbers, it is explained that En, or Ein, or is the only self-existent, whereas it is depth. Vithos, or Vithon, of the Gnostics, called Propatory, is only periodical. The later is Brahma, as differentiated from the Brahma or Parabrahma. It is the depth, the source of light or propator, which is the unmanifested logos of the abstract idea, and not Ein Sof, whose ray uses Adam, Kadmon, or the manifested logos, the objected universe, male and female, as a chariot through which to manifest. But in the Soha, we read the following incongruity: Senior occultus est et, I can't read that, absconditus.
It's senior occultatus est et absconditus. Microprosopus manifestus est et non manifestus.
Microprosopus, I know. This is the fallacy.
I'll translate it when I describe it. I'll translate that.
This is a fallacy, since microprosopus, or the microcosmos, can only exist during its manifestation, and it's destroyed during the Maha Pralaya. Rosenthal's Kabbalah is no guide, but very often a puzzle.
Okay, yeah, we have to keep in mind this book was written in 1888, and often books published then assumed a knowledge, especially knowledgeable books like this, assumed a rudimentary understanding of Latin because it was taught in school. Anyway, first, in the Book of Numbers, it is explained that En, or Ayin, Ayor, is the only self-existent, whereas its depth, Bethos, or Bhuton, of the Gnostics, called Propator, is only periodical. So, Ayin, back to the center, also called En and Ayor, is here being contrasted with Bethos, also called Bhuton and Propator, which only comes into existence during cyclic manifestation. The link between the two is Ayin Sof Aur, that projected beam of light then initiates manifestation, which is represented by the lower 10 Sephiroth. Okay. Next, the latter is Brahma, as differentiated from Brahma or Parabrahm. It is the depth, the source of light, or propator, which is the unmanifested logos or the abstract idea, and not Ein Sof, whose ray uses Adam Kadmon, or the manifested logos, the objective universe, male and female, as a chariot through which to manifest. Okay, the latter here the latter being the periodical Bethos, which HPB here tells us is the source of the light of creation, as opposed to Parabrahm, the absolute. She makes the further point that the ray of Ein Sof, which is Ein Sof Aur, and which emanates from the point at the center of the circle, think in terms of the radius, uses Adam Kadmon as a chariot through which to manifest. So, when we get into the study of the Tree of Life, this will all become a little bit more clear. So in this passage, HPB describes three levels, each with multiple names. At the highest level, we have Parabrahm, Brahma without the circumflex accent over the A, and En, or Ayin, three of the many names for the absolute. Could we get a reader, please?
Okay, but first, I just wanted to say that image that you had a little while ago, Miri says, I've seen this image, but with the man pictured upside down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, often those the source images are shown reversed because it represents the sphere is higher than the mental plane. And the lower quaternary is seen as a mirror image of the higher. By the way, BL, that's her name is pronounced Mady.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll do my best.
Okay. I know it didn't look like that, but there you have it. We all go through that learning process with that name.
And Veronica says, Bihos is the depths of the sea, the Greek word.
Right. And of course, this is the sea of space, and it would be primordial space, not manifested space. And you can get that by looking at these other names, the unmanifested logos, right? The source of light, propator, the original eternal idea. Okay.
Okay, so you wanted a reader for this page?
Yes.
Oh, for this page. Okay, I may be able to read the bottom part, not the top part. Parabrahm is not God because it's not a God. It is that which is supreme and not supreme. Varavara explains Manduka Upanishad. It is supreme as cause, not supreme as effect. Parabrahm is simply as a secondless reality, the all-inclusive cosmos, or rather the infinite cosmic space, in the highest spiritual sense, of course. Brahma, and I don't say that right either, neuter, being the unchanging, pure, free, undecaying, supreme root, the one true existence, Paramarthika, and the absolute chit and chit Anya, intelligence, consciousness, cannot be a cognizer, for that have no subject of mission.
Okay, so, here again, we have an attempt to provide descriptors that will allow us to pitch this, conceptually pitch this higher, right? For instance, Paramarthika cannot be a cognizer. It's not, how can I say this? It is not descended into a stage where the duality necessary for cognition has yet coming to being. So it stands beyond the whole realm of higher mind and cognition. And that's described here, for that, meaning the ultimate, can have no subject of cognition. Yeah. Okay, I think we're gonna stop here because this is, the next section gets deep into this middle part. So, do you have announcements about dates?
Okay, the next Secret Doctrine is going to be the 28th of February. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's the month we're in, right?
No.
28th February.
Not Secret Doctrine, though.
Yeah, no. The next Secret Doctrine is going to be 16 March.
There you go.
And that's when we change back to daylight savings time. So now on 16 March will be 7 p.m. GMT. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages is going to be 2 March, and that's still going to be at 8 p.m. GMT.
And then A Treatise on Cosmic Fire will be a week from Friday, the 28th, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say at first.
Ah, that's what it was. Okay, good. Okay, thank you all. I really do appreciate you hanging in there. This is, we're really in the thick of it when it comes to the spiritual doctrine. Very much like the opening pages of the proem, when she discusses this kind of very high level reality. So thanks for hanging in there. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everybody.